Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and your moderator for today's program. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, sponsored by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It is also being held in association with the Marines Memorial Association. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Sebastian Younger, filmmaker and author of the new book, War, as well as the acclaimed bestseller, The Perfect Storm. I think we're in for a treat tonight, and if you haven't read War, you should. I think it's one of the best stories or books I've read that really conveys the reality of combat in the current age we're in. And Sebastian Younger, as you just heard, is a well-known, very award-winning writer and has won many national awards. Obviously, The Perfect Storm is his most famous book, but he's also written A Death in Belmont and Fire, and he's been a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and ABC News, and he's covered major international conflicts for probably more than 20 years, mainly in Africa and other places around the globe. He's also won the National Magazine Award and the Sias Novatus Prize for Journalism. Now, on to Sebastian Younger. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a real honor to be here tonight. Sorry about all the traffic everyone had to fight through. I had no idea he was coming to town. So I started working as a war reporter in the early 90s. I was a pretty lost freelancer. I was trying to make a living writing for magazines and failing at it. I found a job that paid some good money as a climber for tree companies. I cut my leg pretty badly with a chainsaw up in an elm tree in Massachusetts, and I wasn't permanently injured, but it did permanently get me to take the rest of my life and career seriously. And I sent myself off to Bosnia as a freelancer. I had a bunch of notebooks and a sleeping bag and some pens, and I went over there like a lot of other freelancers and sort of put together a career. And I kept doing it, and my career as a reporter really, I found myself in all of the tragedies of the 90s, Kosovo, Bosnia, Sierra Leone, Liberia, in their 2003. And in all of those wars, they were brought to a stop by Western military action. And so I have a kind of complicated and sometimes conflicted and definitely complicated relationship with the U.S. military or the Western military. The wars that I've covered were so tragic and cost so much in human life and human suffering, and they would be brought to a stop very quickly. And so it was with that mindset that I saw 9/11 unfold. I was actually overseas. I was in Moldova on assignment. And Afghanistan, that I'd been going to, I went there first in 1996. I saw the horror show of the 90s there. Tens of thousands of people killed in the Civil War, an infant mortality rate of 25%, a real incredible tragedy that was pretty much off the radar of the public. I went back in 2000. I was with Ahmad Shah Massoud as he fought the Taliban in the north. I went back after Massoud was killed after 9/11. With his fighters, Massoud's fighters, as they took Kabul. I remember walking around the streets of Kabul, literally getting hugged by Afghans who found out that I was American. And I had the really bizarre experience of being hugged by strangers in the capital of a Muslim country for something the U.S. military had done. It was really disorienting and incredibly gratifying. We really were seen as liberators that unfortunately we didn't capitalize on that as we could have, and the war has gone very badly. It was undermanned, under-resourced. Essentially, we walked away from it into Iraq, and here we are 8-9 years later, casualties mounting, the patience of the Afghans wearing thin. It was for me, a very, very difficult and painful thing to watch this unfold after my experience in 2001. It was that sort of brief shining moment, and then it all fell apart. No one thought, none of the press thought at that point that we would be in Afghanistan 8 years later. And as the years went by and things went worse, I thought, okay, here's this country that I've been to many times, I really care about, and my own country, the United States, we're now sort of like wedded, for better or for worse, for the next probably 20 years. And I should actually, having reported from among the civilian population in war after war in West Africa and the Balkans, Afghanistan, I should find out what it's like to be with the soldiers themselves. It was the one factor in a war that I'd never really reported on. I mean, if you're in Liberia, you're with, quote, soldiers. I mean, they're child soldiers. They're not trained. They're a terrifying social force with AK-47s. But this was different. I thought I should understand my own country's army because they were involved in a country that I was very invested in, very concerned about. So I embedded with battle company of the 173rd Airborne. I knew nothing about the U.S. military. I had no idea that the 173rd Airborne was an incredibly respected, even venerated unit within the U.S. military. Battle company, company is about 150 men. Battle company was one of the really most crack respected units within the 173rd. And I wound up with 2nd Platoon of Battle Company, and they were the best platoon in Battle Company. I wound up with an incredible group of 35 men in the Korangal Valley of eastern Afghanistan in Kunar Province. The Korangal is in the Hindu Kush Mountains, very rugged terrain, 6 miles long. For a while, when I was there, a fifth of all the combat in all of Afghanistan was taking place in the Korangal. 150 men of Battle Company were absorbing a fifth of all the combat for 70,000 NATO troops. The guys were in something like 500 firefights during the course of their deployment. Everyone out there was almost killed, including me, and not in a kind of abstract way. While we're in a war zone, of course, you know, you could be killed in a very specific way. Like, there were guys walking around with holes in their uniforms from bullets that had cut through the fabric and not touched them. I was leaning against a HESCO one morning. HESCO is a big wire basket, 8x8x8, that they lined with a kind of moleskin, and they fill them with dirt to make fortifications. This is what they build outposts out of. You can fill them by bulldozer or, in this case, by hand. I was leaning against the HESCO at one of the outposts and talking to someone, and something you have to understand about bullets is that they go much faster than the gunshots that fire them. So if someone's shooting at you from a distance, you don't know it at first. The sign that you're getting shot at by someone from a distance is there's a very strange and pretty subtle snapping sound that bullets make when they break the sound barrier past your head. And it's a pretty subtle sound. Like, it's the kind of sound where you're not sure you heard it at first, and people glance at each other like, what was that? And by the time you finish the sentence, was that someone shooting at us? You realize someone is, and you hear the gunfire follows later. So at any rate, it's not an obvious thing when someone shoots at you. It takes half a second to kind of confirm it. And so I was leaning against the HESCO talking to someone, and some dirt flew into my face. And I had just time to think, what was that? And then I heard the da-da-da-da-da, and it was the first round of the first burst of an attack that, went on, a firefight that went on for about an hour. And, you know, the bullet hit a few inches from my head. It was close enough to spray me with dirt. Every guy out there had that experience. I was in a Humvee that was blown up by an IED. One of the things that I became very interested in was fear, how we deal with fear. If you're a foreign reporter or a soldier, you have to establish a relationship with fear where you're in control of it. You're not going to make fear go away, and you don't want to, but you do need to be in control of the relationship. And I really tried to examine my own fear and how I dealt with it, because I felt it gave me an insight into how soldiers do the same thing. So when the IED blew us up, it went off under the engine block. We were okay, but the Humvee was on fire, and we were taking fire. We knew we'd have to bail out. It was a very bad situation. What alarmed me was that I wasn't alarmed. I was completely calm. My heart rate was barely, my heart rate was probably 60. I was so flatlined that I thought I'd been wounded. I was like, I must be wounded because this is crazy what's happening. I'm not even reacting. I wasn't wounded. We got out of there. I reacted later. My fear reaction came 6 hours later that night. And I had a real insight into what happens with soldiers. They defer their emotional reaction to what's happening until they have a chance to process it. But that chance doesn't come for a year. So when you see guys that come back and they're just crashing, emotionally crashing, they're doing what I did that day, but they're doing it with an accumulated year's worth of feelings. I was up at an outpost called Restrepo. It was named after the platoon medic, Juan Restrepo, a beloved guy within the platoon. He was shot in the throat on a patrol in a little town called Aliabad, and he bled out trying to tell the guys. I mean, he was the medic, so there was no medic to treat him. He bled out during a firefight trying to tell the guys how to save his life, and they named an outpost after him. The main base in the valley was called the Korngal Outpost. It's the company headquarters, tiny little place, and it would take fire, very effective fire, from the high ground all around it. So the command decided to occupy the high ground, take that away from the enemy. So two platoons walked up this ridge line, 2 hour walk south from the COP, the Korngal Outpost, walked up this ridge line at night with tools and weapons and started digging. They had sandbags. There's no sand up there. It was just a rock, so they had to pick the rock out of the ground with pickaxes, fill the sandbags, pile them up. They worked all night long because they knew they would get hit as soon as it got light. And it got light. They got hit. They dropped their tools, grabbed their weapons, and fought back until the shooting died down. Then they went back to work, and they worked and fought continually for 24 hours to build this outpost. They were attacked 13 times. That day, sometimes from an arc of 360 degrees in the 100-plus degree heat, but they survived. They did it. Only one guy was hit. And that was the outpost that I spent much of 2007-2008 with this platoon. There was no running water up there, so the guys couldn't bathe for a month at a time. That was the rotation up there was about a month. So they just lived in their clothes until their clothes literally fell off them. There was no cooked food up there. They ate MREs. There was no internet. There was no phone. There was no way to call their girlfriends or their wives. They were attacked sometimes 4 or 5 times in a day. They would do patrols into enemy territory, which was the bottom half of the valley, where they would almost guaranteed come into contact. They're up there for a month at a time. They go back to the main base for a few days, take a shower, burn their clothes, get new clothes, call their girlfriends, and go back up. Those are the guys I was with. I say in the book it was a weird kind of anti-paradise up there. Everything that young men like, that young men enjoy, was not up there. There were no women. There was no alcohol. There was no television. There was no sports. There was nothing. The only compelling thing up there was combat. And combat was extremely compelling. And everything that people don't like was up there in abundance, in addition to people trying to kill you. There was tarantulas and snakes and scorpions, and it was incredibly hot in the summer and swarming with flies and crawling with fleas. They wore flea collars. They built these little plywood hooches. For a while, they didn't even have electricity. They got a little generator. They built some plywood hooches to keep themselves warm in the winter. And they built little bunks in them and at all crazy angles. I mean, nothing. They didn't have a level or a plumb line up there. Everything was completely skewed. One hooch was so off kilter that it was a weird optical illusion, and you could put a marble on one of the bunks and swear it was rolling upwards. because all the angles were so crazy. It was really like some bizarre funhouse. You could reach from your bunk. You could reach three other guys with your arm. Everyone was so tightly packed together. Everyone slept ready to go. Their boots on the ground, loosely tied so you could slip your feet into them without the laces trailing. Weapons ready. Body armor ready. Everyone was able to be out the door in 30 seconds because they would attack at dawn. There was an outpost two valleys to the north called Ranch House where the enemy overran it. They were inside the wire. They were fighting hooch to hooch with 9mm handguns. And the lieutenant out there called in airstrikes on himself because they were getting overrun, and it worked. At first, the pilots wouldn't do it. They refused. And he convinced them. He said, we're going to die anyway. You might as well. So the A-10s did gun runs through the American base and saved the Americans who were in it. They sent out a patrol. This is, again, two valleys to the north. The same company sent out a patrol. They wound up with a casualty rate of 80% by the end of the deployment. They sent out a patrol, a 28-man patrol. They got ambushed, and in 3 minutes, every guy was down. Every single guy was hit. So a lot of bad things were happening. And at Restrepo, it was only a 15, 20-man outpost, so it was very vulnerable. And everyone went to sleep knowing, wow, we might wake up to a catastrophic attack and the last minutes or hours of our lives. One of the ways they dealt with the stress and the boredom and the insects and all the unpleasantness up there was with humor. And I'm going to read a short part about a short bit about humor. If you get if you put a bunch of men on a hilltop for a year, they learn how to be very funny. The guys are experts of a sort at being funny, and they seem to go out of their way to be. Maybe it's the only way to stay sane up there. Not because of the combat, you're never saner than when your survival is in question, but because of the unbelievable screaming boredom. Okay, who's going to die today was a standard one-liner before patrols. Their humor, by the way, was incredibly vulgar and very morbid. There was a guy named Anderson who, unfortunately and tragically, two previous Andersons in previous deployments had been killed in the valley. So this Anderson, you know, everyone was like, Anderson, forget it. You're not making it out of the valley. You might as well give me your laptop now because you're not going to make it. Hey, Anderson, what do you want on your tombstone? I heard someone ask before we all headed down to Karangal, which was an enemy village in the south of the valley. Now that's messed up, Anderson muttered as he put on his helmet. Before patrols, guys promised their laptops to each other or their new boots or their iPods. One pair of friends had a serious agreement that if one of them should die, the other would erase all the porn on his laptop before the army could ship it back to his mom. Mothers were an irresistible source of humor, and my apologies to the moms out there. Mothers were an irresistible source of humor. If I start banging your mom when we get home, will that make me your dad? Or some version of that was pretty much boilerplate humor at Restrepo. Once I watched O'Byrne grab someone's ass and give it a good deep squeeze. O'Byrne was the character I really focused on in the book. He was the only guy who got out of the army. He's a civilian now. Everyone else stayed in, half the platoon. They finished their deployment in August 08 and December 09. They went back to Kunar province within miles of the Korangal, and they're all out there now. Once I watched O'Byrne grab someone's ass and give it a good deep squeeze. When the man demanded an explanation, O'Byrne said, I'm just trying to get an idea what your mom's ass is going to feel like when we all get home. Only wives and girlfriends are off limits because the men are already so riddled with anxiety over what's going on back home that almost nothing you could say would be funny. Anything else, mothers, sisters, retarded nephews, was fair game. O'Byrne's an interesting story. He got out. He had a lot of trepidation of getting out. Mainly, that he was afraid that he would miss it. He would miss what was his life at Restrepo. I mean, he hated it, but he was worried that he would miss it. That he would miss the combat. But he got out, and he was worried that he would feel lost in society. Both of those things happened. He got out. We're very good friends. He lives near me. I talk to him probably every day or two. He was at a dinner party with some friends of mine recently, and a woman that I know asked him, Brendan, first name's Brendan, is there anything you miss about being out at Restrepo? I mean, she'd heard the stories, you know. And he said, yeah, I miss almost all of it. And it occurred to me, I mean, I'd already finished the book, but what I realized is that my book was an attempt to make sense of his answer. How is it you can take a young man and put him on a hilltop and kill his best friends and almost kill him for a year and subject him to the deprivation and the hardships that are happening up there? How is it you can do that and bring him back and he misses it? What is it that's going on up on that hilltop that he can't find in society that now feels so essential to his identity, his sense of himself, his sense of purpose in life, that he's willing to risk his life to go back out there to get that feeling again, and he doesn't think that he can achieve it here in society. I think often civilians sort of dismiss, I mean, it's sort of a sort of common knowledge to the point of being a cliche that soldiers kind of miss combat, you know. Certainly, you know, war reporters miss, you know, the excitement of going to war or whatever. And that it's a question of adrenaline. It's often phrased as sort of an adrenaline junkie. I think it's a component of this question, but I don't think it's the major factor. I think what they really miss, I think if you're going to put it in terms of addiction, in terms of a drug, and there are drugs involved in combat, plenty of them. I mean, in drugs in your natural drugs in your system. But if you're going to put it in those terms, I think you can really say that there's that group inclusion is a kind of narcotic, and a probably a more powerful narcotic than adrenaline. Adrenaline is a very transitory thing. The feeling of being included in a group where you're absolutely sure about your role and you're absolutely sure about your relationship to everyone else and their role, and you're completely necessary to the functioning of that group and everyone in that group is necessary to you, that there's a security to that, there's a sureness, there's a kind of necessariness that every person has where they don't have to wonder really about what their worth is, what their value is. When they came back, they returned to, after 14 months, they returned to Vicenza, where their base is. They returned to all the delights of civilization, and they were miserable. They called Vicenza coward's land. It was coward's land because men who had never been in combat could order around men who had. That was a reversal for them. That was a reversal of the natural order of things. It threatened their sense of themselves, their sense of utility. They literally did not know what sense to make of it and how to conduct themselves in according to this new set of rules. Everything up there that was not related to how you functioned in the unit was essentially a footnote to your character. He's a great soldier, but he's kind of, he's kind of cheap or whatever. The cheap part, it's a footnote and it doesn't matter. When they got back to civilization, all those footnotes were the things that characterized you. And that one essential quality of being a good soldier was the one that dropped, that became a footnote. It's very, very confusing to these guys. Brendan O'Byrne said to me at one point, when there wasn't any combat, there was a lot of tension. The guys really did get used to combat, and, you know, if a week or two went by, I mean, and you got to understand, there was nothing else happening up there. There was no TV to watch. There were no girls to ask out on a date. There was nothing. So combat was kind of it, and you know, I remember one very hot day, the lieutenant, there hadn't been a good fight in a week or two, and the lieutenant was sort of shuffled through the outpost, sort of muttering under his breath. I mean, everyone had gone a little weird in the heat, and sort of muttering under his breath, "Oh, please, someone shoot at us today." And I watched this, and, you know, here's a lieutenant in the U.S. Army, in flip-flops that he'd made from packing foam from a missile crate and sort of baggy gym shorts, shirtless, you know, and the lieutenant happened to look exactly like Napoleon Dynamite, you know, including... And he was a great guy. I mean, he was brave, and he was a very, very good officer. He just happened to look like Napoleon Dynamite. And his sort of glasses sort of crooked. And as you know, like, wow, this doesn't look like the U.S. military. This is really this really looks like I'm on some other planet. You know, Brendan, I in those times, the tensions really rose in the platoon, because you get guys psychologically ramped up for combat, and then you take it away, and that energy sort of has nowhere to go. It's very, very difficult. And so Brendan was talking about this, and he said, you know, there's guys in the platoon who straight up hate each other, but we would all die for each other. That is a relationship you can't duplicate back home. There's a security in that which, once you experience it, becomes starts to feel necessary, and I think is a little bit of a kind of drug. The U.S. military has studied fear and studied courage. They're essential things that you have to figure out in combat. They've tried to figure out what is it that gets a person. In the case of combat infantry, it would be a man, not a woman. There's no women in these units. What is it that gets a man to decide that he would rather risk his life for sure and maybe even give his life trying to keep a brother, and that's what they called each other, a brother in the platoon from dying? Now, what is that? It's a profound thing to choose. Like, your life is more important to me than my life. What is that? How does that work? That is an arrangement that far more common, I guess, between family members. You know, your kid runs out into traffic and you dash out there to save him, not really thinking about whether you might get hit by a car. A parent who does that would never consider that quick dash into traffic to save their kid an example of courage, right? It's just completely inapplicable word. That's called being a parent. You'd rather risk your life saving your kid than watch your kid die and live, and you yourself live. Very, very obvious, right? Soldiers have that with each other. And to have that feeling for a peer that you're not related to is a profound thing, and it changes these guys forever, I think. And it changed me watching it. I saw that kind of thing all the time. And, you know, people talk about the traumatic effects of combat, et cetera, et cetera. They are traumatic. The effects are traumatic, but they're not only traumatic. And, you know, I came back, you know, I had my issues when I came back for a little while. You know, I jumped at certain sounds. You know, I found myself getting upset in ways I'd never, you know, so quick to anger in ways I'd never, ever had before. You know, a lot of dreams, like when I was writing my book, every night I was back in the, I mean, literally every night I was back in the Korangal Valley. They weren't necessarily nightmares. Sometimes they were, you know, good combat dreams, but I was in combat every night. But I also, and the soldiers reported this too, I just became way more emotional in a good way. Like, it opened me up. I mean, you know, as a man, I haven't always had amazing access to my emotions, and I'd go to weddings and I'd see often women crying at weddings, and I'd think, what is that? What do you... And, like, now I kind of get that. I have that same, a bit of that same reaction. I'm 48, you know, better late than never, but I do suddenly sort of, something got opened up, and I think it got opened up for all these guys. So when you talk about reaction to combat, just do keep in mind, not all of it's bad. We assume it is, but not all of it is bad. So the military has studied these things. I talk a lot about that in my book. It's a completely non-political book. It's about the experience of soldiers. That's it. I have a lot of political opinions. I can talk about the Afghan war in, you know, capital letters for, you know, hours if you want, but I won't do that tonight. But this book is about the men. And so there are some of these studies in the book, and just two interesting things about that stuff. The issue of fear. Levels of fear that people experience are really not that connected to levels of danger. They're connected to perceived control. If you're in a lot of danger, but you're highly trained, you have less fear. If you feel competent and in control and like, I can deal with this, you have less fear than if you're in very little danger and are completely untrained. So what you have is, in World War II, you had fighter pilots who were completely in charge of their own fate. The problem was they were going out over and over and over again from England in the air war against Germany, over and over and over again, and they suffered a cumulative casualty rate of mortality rate of 50%, right? They had very low levels of fear because they were so highly trained, and they were literally controlling their own destiny. Then you have people on rear bases who are occasionally get mortared or shelled in a random way that they can't do much about, and they're not very well trained. Those people have much higher fear levels and PTSD levels. That becomes very important when you're trying to figure out how to deal with fear on the battlefield. And then there's courage. It's almost impossible to study courage with soldiers because they refuse to admit it exists. I saw during a firefight, a guy went down, and two guys, Sergeant ER and Specialist Moreno, ran through fire. I saw it on the video later. I could see the puffs of, you know, I didn't see it at the time, but I was shooting a lot of video out there. So I'd review the stuff. I'd review the footage later to see what my memory had missed, which was most of it. And I could see bullets impacting the ground in front of us. They ran through that to grab this guy and pull him to safety. Either one of them could have been killed, shot to the head instantly, and they didn't even hesitate. You try to ask those guys, well, you know, you frame your question in terms of courage. They just give you a blank look. They're like, well, look, I mean, our friend was lying hurt, under fire, exposed. Running out there isn't a question of courage. That's just being a soldier. Like, had I not run out there, I wouldn't be a soldier. It's a matter of definition. It's not. There isn't such a thing as, like, a soldier and a brave soldier. The categories they have are soldier and then really not a soldier. Those are the two categories they have. And their definition of soldier includes something that civilians consider incredible bravery. For them, that's just the sort of minimum requirement for the job. It's also the minimum requirement for friendship in their mind. So how does this manifest itself? It's very, very painful for these guys to go on leave. You get an 18-day leave in those 15 months, and they spend the whole time worrying, at least in the back of their mind, if not actively tormented by the thought that in their nine-man squad, their nine-man squad's now down to eight men because they're on leave. And what happens if they get into the kind of firefight that happened with Chosen Company, 100% casualties? What happens when you need one more man and he's not there because he's getting drunk in Fort Lauderdale? What happens? And they really torment themselves about what the thing they fear most is that some mistake, some momentary lapse of courage will get one of their brothers killed. That is the thing that they really worry about, because that you have to live with the rest of your life. If you get killed, you don't have to live with that the rest of your life. And it creates these split-second decisions where everything that they do is affected by trying to help their buddies. I mean, there's moments of fear. I mean, they're human. But when you talk to soldiers about what they fear most, it's causing the death of a friend. That is in their mind, and it dictates almost all of their actions. So in World War II, I'll very quickly read one last section, but in World War II, they did a study about this, and they found that soldiers who were wounded and brought to a rear base hospital would go AWOL. They would literally crawl out the windows as soon as they were able and make their go AWOL, risk disciplinary action, and make their way back out to the front line to rejoin their units because they were so worried about the guys, about their brothers out there. So I'm going to read a short section, and then we'll move on to questions. One night a few weeks later, I'm sitting on the ammo hooch listening to the monkeys in the peaks. A temperature inversion has filled the valley with mist, and the mist is silver in the moonlight and almost liquid. Airborne is the platoon dog. He would go on patrols, he'd walk point, he would take cover during firefights. He was an amazing dog. They named him Airborne because this was an airborne unit, and the unit that was following them into the valley was a regular infantry unit. Airborne refer to regular infantry as legs because they're not qualified to jump out of an aircraft. They have to walk everywhere. And as you can imagine, airborne looks down at legs, right? So the dog was going to stay at the outpost. So what they named him Airborne, so that when the 1st Infantry Division, the legs unit, was going to come in to take over, they would spend the whole next year calling for their dog, calling him Airborne, and reaffirming their crushing inferiority every time they called for the dog. Airborne is asleep but keeps popping his head up to growl at some threat impossibly far below us in the valley. There's been a big fight over by the Pakistan border, and F-15s and 16s have been powering overhead all evening looking for people to kill. O'Byrne wanders out and we start talking. His head is shaved, but dirt sticks to the stubble so you can see where his hair ought to be. He says he signed a contract with the Army that's almost up, and he has to figure out whether to reenlist. Combat is such an adrenaline rush, he says. I'm worried I'll be looking for that when I get home, and if I can't find it, I'll just start drinking and getting in trouble. People back home think we drink because of the bad stuff, but that's not true. We drink because we miss the good stuff. It's a stressful way to live, but once it's blown out your levels, almost everything else looks boring. O'Byrne knows himself. When he gets bored, he starts drinking and getting into fights, and then it's only a matter of time before he's back in the system. If that's the case, he might as well stay in the system, a better one, and actually move upward. I suggest a few civilian jobs that offer a little adrenaline, wilderness trip guide, firefighter, but we both know it's just not the same. We're at one of the most exposed outposts in the entire U.S. military, and he's crawling out of his skin because there hasn't been a good firefight in a week. How do you bring a guy like that back into the world? Civilians balk at recognizing that one of the most traumatic things about combat is having to give it up. War is so obviously evil and wrong that the idea there could be anything good to it almost feels like a profanity. And yet throughout history, men like Mack and Rice and O'Byrne have come home to find themselves desperately missing what should have been the worst experience of their lives. To a combat vet, the civilian world can seem frivolous and dull, with very little at stake and all the wrong people in power. These men come home and quickly find themselves getting berated by a rear-based major who's never seen combat, or arguing with their girlfriend about some domestic issue they don't even understand. When men say they miss combat, it's not that they actually miss getting shot at. You'd have to be deranged. It's that they miss being in a world where everything is important and nothing is taken for granted. They miss being in a world where human relations are entirely governed by whether you can trust the other person with your life. It's such a pure, clean standard that men can completely remake themselves in war. You could be anything back home, shy, ugly, rich, poor, unpopular, and it won't matter because it's of no consequence in a firefight and therefore of no consequence, period. The only thing that matters is your level of dedication to the rest of the group, and that is almost impossible to fake. That's why the men say such impossibly vulgar things about each other's sisters and mothers. It's one more way to prove nothing can break the bond between them. It's one more way to prove they're not alone out there. War is a big and sprawling word that brings a lot of human suffering into the conversation, but combat is a different matter. Combat is the smaller game that young men fall in love with, and any solution to the human problem of war will have to take into account the psyches of these young men. For some reason, there is a profound and mysterious gratification to the reciprocal agreement to protect another person with your life, and combat is virtually the only situation in which that happens regularly. These hillsides of loose shale and holly trees are where the men feel not most alive, that you can get skydiving, but the most utilized, the most necessary, the most clear and certain and purposeful. If young men could get that feeling at home, no one would ever want to go to war again, but they can't. So here sits Sergeant Brendan O'Byrne, 1 month before the end of deployment, seriously contemplating signing back up. I prayed only once in Afghanistan, O'Byrne wrote me after it was all over. It was when Restrepo got shot, and I prayed to God to let him live. But God, Allah, Jehovah, Zeus, or whatever a person may call God, wasn't in that valley. Combat is the devil's game. God wanted no part. That's why our prayers weren't answered. The only one listening was Satan. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Uh,
Our thanks to Sebastian Younger, filmmaker and author of the new book, War, as well as the acclaimed bestseller, The Perfect Storm, for his comments this evening. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions, many questions, so let's begin. The questions really break down into people wanting you to be the oracle about Afghanistan in the future, personal experiences, and a range of things. So one of the things I'll do a little bit is read some of the book, because some of the things you say lead right into the questions. But one of the things that's really clear in the book is that the soldiers you're with really have little sense of politics. They're there as a group of you described. And you talk about, in one wonderful sequence in the book, the concluding line is you talk about the role of the government is the evaluation, ongoing and unadulterated by politics. May the one thing a country absolutely owes the soldiers who defend its borders. So shortly after last year, recently, we left the Korangal Valley after this huge commitment was made there. So what do you, here's a question from the audience. Does this signify mission accomplished, or was this mission impossible? And does this development, the departure from the Korangal, augur well or ill, if at all, for the ultimate success of what we're doing in Afghanistan?
I mean, I think you have to realize that war is such a complex system. It's impossible to make the right decision 100% of the time. It's just impossible. It's not a realistic expectation. Every war has its OP Restrepo, has its Dunkirk, has its Hamburger Hill. That's part of war. It's part of the loss and the tragedy of war. If men only died taking significant terrain, war would probably feel a lot different to the combatants. But unfortunately, that's not the case. The Afghan effort was undermanned and underfunded for years, and I think it probably still is. They fought very hard in the Korangal Valley. Their presence there had a certain logic in 2005, 2006, and either it was a false logic or the situation changed and it became an obsolete logic. And I'm not in a position to tell one from the other. Maybe no one is. I know that the enemy, having fought very, very hard there and having lost hundreds of fighters in the Korangal, also dropped their operations there to a very, very low level in the year prior to the U.S. pullout. So both sides in a war make decisions like that. It's very, very easy to condemn choices from 5 years ago. Some of them are definitely worth condemning, for sure, but not every single one. I think the commanders just decided that they don't have enough men, and the 150 guys who were in the Korangal were better used elsewhere.
Well, look ahead a little bit. If you had a chance to speak to the president tonight, what advice would you give him about the strategy looking forward in Afghanistan?
Oh, God.
He's here. He's actually coming in 5 minutes.
Is he out there? I keep getting asked, is it winnable? Is it doable? And my answer, maybe it's a little pat, I don't know. But my answer is, look, the Allies managed to push the German army out of Western Europe and defeat them in their homeland, right? The Allies pulled off D-Day. There's 10, 20,000 Afghan fighters, lightly armed, half of them barefoot, in the mountains of Afghanistan. It's not a military problem. Enough men over there, enough resources could do it. I just don't know what that level is. The real question is there the political will in the countries that supply these men to actually make that decision and send them over there? I think either we should get out or we should do it right. And I'm very, very strongly inclined towards doing it right. I was there in the 90s. I saw the level of bloodshed, the level of tragedy in that country. It was a tragedy not of their own making, although they certainly perpetuated it. And it's going to go back to that. I mean, you think 500 civilian casualties a year is bad in Afghanistan? That's what it was last year, something like that, due to U.S. actions. Try tens of thousands in the 90s. It was a horror show. So what I would say, my advice, the chaos in Afghanistan has reached out and touched every country in Europe, either through a refugee population, through drugs and opium, or through terrorist attacks, the London subway bombings, the Madrid train bombings, attempted attacks in just about every other country in Europe, Algeria and Morocco. All of those countries have a vested interest in Afghanistan not lapsing back into a rogue state without extradition treaties where criminals can hide out beyond the reach of international law. And what I don't understand, I really do not understand, is that considering that situation, why the U.S. and England and Canada are the three countries providing something like 90% of the military effort over there, I don't get it. And if I were President Obama, I would say, we've been doing this for 10 years, we're going to do it till next summer, and if we don't see a real effort by the rest of the world, including Muslim countries, I mean, Al-Qaeda was attacking Egypt, Algeria, Morocco, Jordan, those regimes are in trouble too, and they're not nice regimes, but they want to survive. Everyone should be contributing because the effects will potentially affect everybody. If I were Obama, I would say, we're doing this till next summer, and if you all don't step up, we're out of here, and we'll all take our chances. Thank you.
Part of doing it right, you sort of gave the answer, and I'm going to read a paragraph because it goes to the nature of the combat there. And you wrote, for every technological advantage held by the Americans, the Taliban seem to have an equivalent or a countermeasure. Apache helicopters have thermal imaging that reveals body heat on the mountainside, so Taliban fighters disappear by covering themselves in a blanket on a warm rock. The Americans use unmanned drones to pinpoint the enemy, but the Taliban can do the same thing by watching the flocks of crows that circle American soldiers looking for scraps of food. The Americans have virtually unlimited firepower, so the Taliban send only one guy to take on an enemy entire firebase. Whether or not he gets killed, he will have succeeded in gumming up the machine for yet one more day. So in the descriptions in the book, and one of the questions was, they seem to have sophisticated weaponry. But part of the remarkable nature of the combat in the Korangal was the intelligence the Americans used. Can you want to describe the network, the radio network, and address the issue of adaptation by the Taliban?
Yeah, I mean, in war, each side is adapting to the advantages of the other side. And the Americans have incredible optics. So if they can spot an AK-47 on a guy at night, you know, from 40,000 feet and drop a bomb on him. So what do? They don't carry their weapons at night. They leave them hidden in the hills. Every asset we have, every advantage, they have an answer to, and vice versa. The Americans are very heavily armored and have massive firepower. The Taliban are very mobile. It's a classic, army versus insurgent argument, tactical argument. I do think that, there was 150 men in that valley, and there was a lot of fighting, and an awful lot of people got killed. If there had been a battalion in that valley, I don't think there would have been much of a fight. They would have had outposts like Restrepo on every significant piece of high ground, and the enemy could not have moved without getting shot at. So I think at the end of the day, technology works. It's great. But air power was half an hour away. There is an aspect of war, even with a modern army like ours, that really comes down to men on the ground with rifles. And there were not enough of them. In my opinion, there were not enough of them in that valley. And all the optics in the world aren't going to change that.
Okay. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Sebastian Younger, filmmaker and author of the new book, War, as well as the acclaimed bestseller, The Perfect Storm. Can you describe, because maybe some people in the audience know that there was also a movie out of what you did, Restrepo, which I guess you told me is about to be general release, but you get a visual sense of that. Do you want to describe a little bit what Restrepo was like and what it looked like up there? And tell people what it was like and the view and the rigorous nature of what patrols were like.
Yeah, I had a video camera with me. My partner out there did too. We shot 150 hours of video and made a documentary. It's not about the wider war. It's not about Afghanistan. It's certainly not about George Bush. It is about this platoon in the Korangal Valley. We never ask a general, why are we in the Korangal? We never ask a diplomat about the Afghan conflict. The camera is with the soldiers the entire time. We're very proud of it. It's 90 minutes long. We think of it as a 90-minute deployment for the viewers, and we won Sundance with it. So we're very proud of it. But thank you. It's a companion work to my book. It comes out in late June, distributed by National Geographic. But just to describe the place out there that we shot so much video of, It was a rocky outcrop at around 5,500 feet, 1,000 feet above the valley floor, with some holly trees that were shot to pieces and some shale rock, and it was dust, and there was sage, and the sage smelled really good in the morning. You go on patrol, and it was this lovely smell of sort of sage. It made me think I was in Wyoming, except I wasn't. And these incredible views. There were huge cedar trees on the upper ridges. They looked like sequoias. They were absolutely enormous. It looked like Colorado. It was absolutely beautiful. At the bottom of the valley were these rivers, these big boulders, sort of kayaking rivers, except no one was kayaking. And it was just an absolutely gorgeous place, except for what was happening there.
There's terrific character development in the book, and you obviously forged a bond with some of them. And tell us what someone like Bobby Wilson, describe who he was and where he came from and what he symbolized to you in terms of what we're doing with young men and sending them off to wars.
Well, Bobby Wilson was a tough character. I mean, he described himself as a redneck. He was a redneck, except he was incredibly smart, and his whole redneck thing was kind of an act. I mean, he was from Georgia, I think, Alabama, I can't remember, but he was incredibly smart, and he had incredibly thick fingers, and he was incredibly just stocky and strong. He didn't look in very good shape, but he was insanely strong. I mean, he almost like he had, wasn't muscles, but some kind of hydraulic system on him. He was an outrageous guy. I mean, I don't think I can fully describe Bobby on something that's going to air on the radio. But he was one of the guys who was just incredibly funny and incredibly brave. And if you have those two qualities at a place like Restrepo, you are the king, one of the kings. He was just, and there were half a dozen guys like that who you think. I mean, he signed up for the Army. How did it go? He went on a bender, came out of it. His girlfriend broke up with him. So he went on another bender, woke up on his father's front lawn, walked into the house. He and his father got drunk. And when he woke up the third time, he went into the recruiting office to join the Marines, and they said they wouldn't have him. And too many tattoos and too hungover, basically. And so he went down the hall to the Army, and they said, sure.
Talk about, in terms of what, again, I think one of the challenges or issues, I think, in this country today is a very small group of young men and women are in the service, and the war is almost invisible to most of the public. Describe a little bit about Operation Rock Avalanche and the preparations and the loads and just the rigor of, what that meant, daily patrol. I mean,
yeah. So on multi-day operations, the guys, the bulletproof vest they had that I had as well was 25 pounds. They'd have 30, 40 pounds of ammo. The weapon weighs 20 pounds or so. If they're carrying a heavy machine gun, 25 pounds. It adds up pretty quickly. You need a lot of water and some food. And pretty soon you're carrying 150 pounds, 160 pounds. The guys were in steep terrain at high altitude, essentially carrying another man on their back. The physical effort expended, I mean, forget about the fighting, just that they could do that physically, it was just kind of awe-inspiring. One of my biggest fears was that I would slow them down. I was in my mid-40s, I think I was 45 when I was out there a few years ago, and that would slow them down. I mean, you slow down a patrol, and the enemy has time to maneuver on you, and someone gets killed. And that, to me, was the ultimate nightmare scenario. And so, I mean, I'm in good shape, and I was fine. I never slowed anyone down. But I would sort of comfort myself with this idea of, like, okay, I'm twice their age, but I'm carrying half their weight. And actually, that equation worked pretty well. And I just had this arrangement with myself. You can't prevent what your body's going to do. I mean, if you're going to physically collapse, your body's going to physically collapse. And I was a competitive runner in high school and college, and I know what that process is like, and I know how far away I am from it. But you can control your mind. And usually the mind gives up long before the body does. You start negotiating with yourself, it hurts too much, you start cutting deals, and suddenly you're slowing down. As a competitive runner, I knew how not to start that negotiation. I knew how to just unhook that negotiation and let it not happen. And I'm very good at telling my body to do something until it can't do it anymore. And it's something I learned when I was young, and it stood me in good stead. And I found myself calling on resources and calling on a mental way of confronting pain and effort that I hadn't really had to call on since college. And it worked, and I never slowed down a patrol. My idea was, as long as there's one soldier who's slower than me, I'm good, because at least he's, you know, it's like not my, morally, it's not my responsibility.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Sebastian Younger, filmmaker and author of the new book, War. Do you like being called a filmmaker now?
You know, I mean, yes, in a kind of weird way. I think of myself as a journalist, you know, so people call me author, too, and I'm like, well, I mean, kind of, but really I'm a journalist. I keep coming back to that. Journalism involves, you know, has many different expressions, and but ultimately that's the core word for me.
You were in, as you described, astonishingly close proximity with the platoon. So in the news today is Don't Ask, Don't Tell. How what do you think would happen in a situation like that if the rules were changed in terms of the relationships of men in combat?
I never asked them directly that because it didn't interest me that much out there, but the sense that I got was, and I asked one guy later, actually, as that question started to come up on my book tour, if there was a guy out there who was gay and he wasn't making passes at the other guys, that would not go well. But if he wasn't doing that, and he was a good soldier and committed and brave and et cetera, they, I think, literally would not think about it. I mean, they would joke about it, but they joked about everything. It just would not matter. It really isn't room for prejudice of any sort in a situation where everyone's life depends on everyone else. There just isn't. So the problem with that, I think, is more on the rear bases, where there's less danger, more leisure time, the margins are huge, and essentially there's the luxury of for some people to indulge their prejudice. There isn't that luxury out at a place like OP Restrepo. And interestingly, the rationale for the policy is that they don't want to undermine unit cohesion with that issue. But I think what they don't understand is that the units that need that cohesion, it wouldn't matter anyway. So it is a weird kind of circular logic that they're using when they discuss that issue.
I'm going to read something you wrote. War is supposed to feel bad because undeniably bad things happen in it, but for a 19-year-old at the working end of a 50 caliber during a firefight that everyone comes out of okay, war is life multiplied by some number that no one has ever heard of. In some ways, 20 minutes of combat is more life than you could scrape together in a lifetime of doing something else. Combat isn't where you might die, though that does happen. It's where you find out whether you get to keep on living. Don't underestimate the power of that revelation. Don't underestimate the things young men will wager in order to play that game one more time. When you set out to do this book, what did you have in mind to do? Was that the kind of insight you thought would come? What was the story you were looking to tell?
I was pretty open-ended. I mean, I wanted to chronicle the experience of one platoon in combat for a year. And I also wanted to keep my mind open to a less literal and more thoughtful understanding of what it meant psychologically, morally, philosophically, to spend a year taking your chances getting killed and, for the soldiers, killing other people. I thought there was a lot of food for thought in that. And so, I mean, on one level, I was just trying to do a good job as a reporter, chronicling their experience. On another level, as a human being, I wanted to understand that experience as deeply and fully and as philosophically as possible. And that, I think it was those sort of mental endeavors while I was out there and while I was writing the book later that actually made the project changing one for me, quite a profound and emotional one for me.
What'd your wife think of all this?
You know, it was a complicated conversation, but I mean, basically, I traded this for not doing this anymore. That was the trade. After this, I'm going to keep reporting overseas, but I'm not going to do, 5 months with a maneuver unit in, a small outpost in the Korangal Valley, that kind of thing. And, frankly, even if I weren't married, I don't think I would do it again. Risking your life at the end of the day feels miserable, and there are reasons to do it, but there are very few reasons to endlessly do it.
How did you manage the ability to leave and come back and leave and come back in terms of reentry into this surreal life you were having over this period of time?
Brendan O'Byrne said at one point, we were talking about fear, and he said, some of the scariest stuff out there never happened. And what he meant was that, in combat, you just kind of went blank, and you went blank and hopefully were highly functional, but you kind of went blank. The real fear happened before big operations, before expected attacks. And sometimes the operations, got called off or the attacks never happened, and you were left with this sort of load of fear, of dread. It really was dread. Dread was the worst feeling out there. Fear was, it just didn't happen in quite that way. So whenever I went over there, I had the dread in the weeks beforehand. And then when I got there, it was kind of a relief. Like, okay, because your imagination is always much worse than the reality. And there's nothing you can do about your imagination. Once you're there, you can be kind of proactive about the things that scare you. And then I would come back, and I would have this sort of hangover from out there. Civilian life, married life, social life is complicated and subtle, and you can miss some small cues that lead to bad results. What I'm talking about, right? So, at the outpost, there were no small cues. It's like if someone had a problem with you, it was stated pretty boldly, and it was hard to miss. And it's just like. The building blocks they used were just bigger and more obvious, and it was, I don't know, it was psychically simpler. And so it was always kind of hard to leave there because it felt like such, in its weird way, minus the combat, it was incredibly relaxing. You just didn't, I don't know if this is a problem with, the male brain or whatever, but you did not have to keep on top of the details. You know what I mean? It's like, it was very black and white and simple. And that's, that for men, that's kind of a health spa. You know what I mean?
Okay. I'm glad I asked. Unfortunately, we've reached in our program, but maybe one more question, maybe one and a half. But your own back and forth reentry. Was complicated, but you knew you weren't a soldier. How do the men, the actual combatants, how do you think they can go back and forth? And we didn't really get into your own potential PTSD, but you knew men who were killed. What are we doing, or what can be done for these guys when they come back now? It's so intense.
Yeah. They're all, except for Brendan, they're all in the Army. They're not coming back to civilian life. For at least another few years. But, I take the meaning of your question. Eventually, they are going to come back. They're going to come back whether you supported the war, where you're for the war, against the war. They're all coming back. As the citizenry, your political opinions aren't relevant to the fact that they're returning home and have to be reincorporated into society. And so I think one thing that's very important is when you deal with vets, there's a... War has to be understood politically and argued about and disagreed about because it's such a terrible thing. But you really don't want to understand their experience through a political lens because they aren't. They weren't when they signed up. They really signed up to serve their country. It was a very simple thing. There's Democrats out there. There's Republicans. There's Doves. There's Hawks. There's everything in that platoon. That's not what it was about. It was about a very profound belief in serving their country, and you are their country. So when you deal with these guys, you can be proud of them regardless of how you feel about the war. And if you make that clear to them, that goes a long way. In terms of services, the wives are the ones who are really now fighting a lonely fight. The guys are on the battlefield with themselves, in a group. The wives are alone in these homes, in these families. fighting a very lonely fight. And I think the way to get to a guy who has problems, the way to help him is to help his wife who's helping him. These women are alone. They're very courageous. They're very sometimes quite lost and confused. And I think I sort of think of it as the hidden war now, the sort of new front in this hidden war. It's what's happening at home. And I think really there's a lot of resources being put into the men, as there should be. I think the next step really is to look at the women who are with them. They're bearing the brunt of it. And I think the solution ultimately lies with them. Thank you.
Our thanks to Sebastian Younger, filmmaker and author of the new book, War, as well as the proclaimed bestseller, The Perfect Storm. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, sponsored by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It has also been held in association with the Marine Memorial Association. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.